Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
And welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team.
This week on the show, the beloved trade of 2019 is being tested. Recession fears have faded, sentiment has turned incrementally more positive, and that sent bond yields higher, and it's now pressuring stock investors that were before playing defense. Is this the start of something new, or is it just a false dawn?
And as always, we'll end the episode with our tradition, the craziest thing I saw in markets this week. Sarah, I presume you're prepared for that segment?
I am prepared, but I have a feeling that you have a very special one.
I have a very special edition of the craziest thing I saw in markets this week. But let's get right to it. I mean, sort of a crazy week in the bond market. We're seeing a really notable back up in yields. And luckily, by happenstance, we happen to have the perfect guest to help us break it down. From PGIM, we have Robert Tipp, who is the chief investment strategist at PGIM. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And it's good to have a Jersey guy, I would say, too. At least you work in Jersey, in Newark, if my notes are correct.
Well, I'm quite diverse. I commute from Westchester, so I drive through, you know, quite a range of geography.
Oh, that's
very regional.
Yeah.
That's a nightmare of a commute, I imagine. No comment.
Well, it's not, you know, at least it's not a most commonly trodden path.
That's true. And also joining us this week, commuting all the way from Greenwich Village, we have Chris Nagy, the executive editor of Markets at Bloomberg. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, Mike.
Thanks
for identifying where I live.
Well, that's true. Anyone looking for Chris, you can find
him. I know where you live.
Greenwich Village is pretty big, right?
Yeah.
Well, you got people looking for you, Chris?
Based on some of our Trump stories, yes.
So Trump fans and debt collectors can find Chris Nagy. Okay. Robert, I got to sort of pat your team on the back. So I was looking at some of the returns on the funds this year, especially the PGIM Total Return Bond Fund, up 10% year to date. Wow. But not only that, it's performance compared to peers is really impressive. A one-year basis, according to our data, it's in the 95th percentile. 5 years, it's in the 89th percentile. What's going right? I mean, obviously, we've had this ferocious rally in bonds, but what are you guys doing especially right to have these really great numbers?
Sure. Well, thanks. You know, we take a long-term approach. So we're looking at the overall backdrop, the macro economy, policy, monetary, fiscal, not just in the U.S., but globally. And so much so these days, what happens in the bond market is really a global phenomena. The balance of borrowing and lending is really driven almost more so by the amount of savings coming out of foreign countries than what's going on here just domestically in the U.S. that would impact, a general intermediate bond fund. And so when we look at the big picture, even just in the U.S., the market's quite sensitive to interest rates. And when they've been up well north of 2%, the economy is really kind of bogged down a bit, especially the interest rate sensitive sector. And it'll give you the message that the equilibrium interest rate here is lower than most people think. And when we look abroad, the money is pouring across the transom. Most places have negative rates. People are paying to park their money in these countries. Or if they're buying long-dated securities, they might be zero yield, long-term zero coupon bonds, you know, that have an asymmetric looking risk return profile. And so the money's come over here as well. Even if on a hedged basis, when they eliminate currency risk, they end up with a negative yield on a standstill basis, but at least over here, yields are well north of zero. Maybe you have some upside as well as downside. And so I think, you know, that's driven us to a secular view that rates would be declining, and we've positioned for that.
Is there anything in this sell-off in the bond market this week that sort of changes your stance on all of that? Is it a turning point, or is this just sort of a little bit of a correction in a very much an overbought treasury market?
Well, I wish I could give you the answer. but, you know, what we've seen over the years in the secular bull market that we've had in bonds for 40 years, at any given point in time, you may have a cyclical upturn. And expectations and views of economies around the world have become pretty morose. And so you can get a backup in the bond market driven by technical conditions. And I think to a large extent, what we've seen so far is kind of an equal and opposite reaction to the panic buying that we saw not too long ago. And we'll have to see if the fundamentals follow through. But our base case would be that the range, say, for the 10-year treasury is maybe 1.5 to 2.5, but probably more likely something more like 1 to 2. And that we're going to see these fundamentals reassert themselves and cause rates to stabilize or maybe even fall again.
So we did see a pretty major backup in yield this week, the 10-year once again, approaching 2%, which is a level we hadn't seen in at least a couple of months. Because when you think about your lower for longer thesis, much of that does have to do with where yields are overseas. Does that just mean that there is a cap on where U.S. Treasury yields can go going forwards? Because no matter what, as long as they're higher than yields overseas, you're always going to have some sort of demand?
I think it creates a friction. And so what we've seen in the sell-off is the Treasuries have sold off less than foreign bonds. And in these, the key global markets, JGBs, bunds, European bonds, Japanese bonds, there has been a sell-off. And, you know, there's a whiff of change in the air in both of these places. In Japan, they've been trying to steepen their yield curve, push up long-term yields to leave more on the table for insurers, for banks. And in Europe, you have a change of leadership at the ECB. So people, you know, questioning, will there be this unflinching commitment to incredibly low rates and QE going forward? And so I think the level of yields, the spread being at you know, your 95th type percentile of multi-decade levels relative to much higher than these foreign yields, that creates a cushion, but it doesn't create a lid.
I wanted to dig in a little bit on the, I was looking at the PGIM Total Return Bond Fund. I think it's one of your biggest, right? About $50 billion in assets. And I was looking at sort of the allocations and the holdings. Now, this is, our data is at the, as of the end of August, so not necessarily current, but a couple things really caught my eye. 40% mortgages, 37% corporate, about 18% government. But looking at the individual top holdings, there were a few USD euro swaps, USD British pound swap. So walk us through, and I think those were all about like 4 or 5% of the allocation. So pretty big positions. Now, I'm a stock guy, so I don't necessarily know what's going on with these, but my guess is these were basically bets on rate spreads, yield spreads narrowing between the U.S. and Europe. Is that the safe way to describe it?
Our risks are principally domestic.
Yeah.
And a currency risk, foreign interest rate risk is going to be very limited. And so preponderance of swaps that will be used in the fund will be issue selection driven. So we may find that a U.S. issuer issues in euros, maybe at a wider spread than in the U.S. We buy that bond and we hedge it back to the U.S. Now, we have had, you know, at different points in time, you know, small positions in foreign interest rate risk or even FX on the foreign currency side. But those tend to be very small, not as large as that magnitude generally.
Right, right.
Chris, come in here and give us the equity view, because it's not only yields that have been rising this week. I mean, stocks have been rising and pretty forcefully, too, at that.
Yeah. I feel like stocks are happy to see yields go up. I mean, the big equity perspective on that is that something going on with bonds and yields in the curve means recession's coming. So anything that kind of undoes that argument. Now, you're saying that just as big an issue would be yields getting too high at this point. Kind of reminds me of a saying we have on the desk, which is, whatever the hell happens, it's bad. I guess we shouldn't get too comfortable with the relief we're feeling over seeing a little bit of unwinding in the curve and all of these, you know, sort of unbelievably reliable recession indicators.
Well, it's true that, you know, the the good news that's boosting the equity market, whether it was less worse than feared earnings or some optimism on the trade front, that's it's bad for yields until yields get too high and they begin to choke off what's going in the equity market. But so far, we're in the sweet spot where you have some concerns on the rate side, but a rising risk appetite, enough economic optimism to outweigh, you know, the rise in discount rates.
So is the last few weeks in markets, how much would you attribute it to the trade optimism, and how much would you attribute it to the Fed apparently being on hold, but yet still sort of doing what it can to keep the repo market in order with the short-term Treasury purchases? I mean, how big of a deal is the Fed, at least in the rates market right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are excellent points. I think that the risk on makes people wonder, you know, gee, is it really over for bonds? Should I have more equities? And on the retail side, there have been a lot of outflows from equities. So there's some of that. I think, though, we have shifted in market environment from one where central banks had wound down their quantitative purchases, their QE buys. And that was bad for risk. I mean, what we saw, for example, in 2009 in these previous instances of aggressive QE is it dampened equity volatility, it pushed up stock markets, it pushed down volatility. And we had moved away from that. Last year was a very volatile year where risk product had a hard time going anywhere and there was much less liquidity coming into the system. So now we've gone back into bill buying, you know, and a rising Fed balance sheet. The ECB is back in buying. Bank of Japan is slowing their purchases, but at a very slow rate. And at the same time, they are, in a way, remodeling their policy because they feel they will be incredibly accommodative for even longer than anticipated. So I think the accommodation, the liquidity injection, has tended to bear steepen the curve a little bit, and we're seeing some of that here.
You know, at the same time, you look at the data that's come in so far for the fourth quarter and you kind of distill it down to these nowcasts that the Fed does. The Atlanta Fed's GDP now model, I think, is at like 0.9% growth for the fourth quarter. The New York Fed's one is even lower. I think it's like 0.8. So, you know, some of the lowest growth potentially we've seen in this cycle. Albeit, you know, models that tend to jump around a lot. There's still a lot of data to come in for the quarter. But are markets getting a little bit ahead of themselves on the optimism here this week?
Well, I think so. I mean, our base case of a 1% to 2% range would suggest you're getting near the top of the range. And as you're highlighting this week, the news has not been really positive on the fundamental side in terms of what really matters for rates markets, which to some extent is really the real economy. Do people need to borrow a lot of money to invest? Durable goods, big picture, those numbers are very flat. We had this week another poor industrial production figure coming from the European side. And so basically, you know, that would suggest that more likely than not, there was some exuberance when the rates were rallying. And then some people are asking themselves, what were we doing? And a little bit of panic selling here.
Chris, does it seem as though the stock market is maybe getting a bit ahead of itself too? I mean, you just look at where we're seeing the outperformance lately, and energy stocks are really on a tear this week. You look at other cyclical areas of the market. Is it possible that this is just beta chasing?
In a way, yes. I feel like what's going on in the equity market reflects this sort of standard word is rotation going on, that there's a lot of people who've been caught short by this rally. And let's face it, if the market stopped dead right here at 25% basically year to date, no one would have any reason to complain. I'm sure they would complain, in fact.
There's always a reason.
Yeah. If you're a fund manager who's watched this happen and has been wedded to defensive shares or bond proxies, and now the bond market's rolling or to some degree rolling over, and you're stuck with all of that stuff and you're watching everything take off, I mean, it's a sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. You're gonna need to dive back in and grab some beta.
It reminds me of a story your team had out this week about the percentage of active equity mutual fund managers who are beating.
They're getting killed.
Was it 29% or beating the benchmark?
They're always getting killed, but they're getting killed a little worse right now for some of these reasons. And it's a bad year, I think, probably to look bad. I mean, everyone's going to be, I mean, to the degree people care about performance, I feel like everyone should look at their returns and their 401k and say, oh, man, I made 25% this year, but that's not how the professional class will look at it. And this is sort of the big sort of melt up thesis right now, that there's going to be a lot of people diving back into the market in the next 2 months to try to make those numbers. And it's like, look out above if that starts to happen.
Yeah, what do you think the chances of that are? I mean, we're obviously seeing it to some degree. Does it continue through till the end of the year?
Walking in here, I probably would have said pretty good. As I listened to our guest and some of the signals coming from the bond market, I think that's ultimately the determinant. If the economy doesn't go anywhere, and what I know about is the economy is earnings, and earnings in the fourth quarter look like they're going to suck. So the ultimate determinant will be whether or not the macro picture is good enough for stocks. And, you know, the supply and demand and chasing beta things are a factor for a little while, but they won't call the ultimate tune.
Much of this reversal has been predicated on the idea that we are seeing a stabilization in growth. We could see a nice rebound in 2020. And I did do my homework, Robert. I dug up something that you said on Bloomberg Television last week. And after the employment report, you said this is a picture-perfect soft landing. It's what they're on track for, talking about the Federal Reserve. Is that actually what we're seeing? And if so, wouldn't that bode very well then for risk assets?
I think so. And I think the comment I made was that Powell's been criticized, you know, for how he's handled the press conferences. And I think they did a pretty flat-footed last hike last year, you know, one too many. But I think in a way, they kind of wanted to stick their finger in the eye of the president who had been badgering them. And so they managed to do that without doing too much damage. They've whipped around. They've cut three times, which was, you know, going every meeting, every 6 weeks, as opposed to when they were hiking, which, you know, they were only moving once a quarter. So they quickly cut. And they may be there for the soft landing. And so our hypothesis, frankly, for some time is that although this is a moribund economic backdrop, it is not as much growth as people would want to see. It is not a feel-good economy for people. That in the markets, you have a declining equilibrium interest rate. You have a very long business cycle because these central banks have prevented really big financial excesses from building up. And they have not jumped in and crushed the economy with rate hikes, which is typically what kills it. So I think what's shocking to people is you are having a very extended cycle. They're on track to continue this. And so as a result, your rates are likely to remain low. Your period of spread sector outperformance continues, and your equity market continues to look quite competitive in terms of earnings yields and valuations relative to a bond market with yields this low.
I feel like there's a point to be made here about the stock market being an economic input unto itself. That's sort of a lucky break that they get here, that the one thing that could, not the one, obviously the consumer remains strong. One of the reasons the consumer remains strong, you saw this after the fourth quarter of last year when the market tanked, some of the animal spirits kind of got beaten out. But right now, a lot of people are sitting with a lot of money thanks to the stock market, and that's part of the big eco bull case.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm glad you brought up the consumer, Chris. That brings me back to looking at the PGIM Total Return Bond Fund. 40% mortgages. Is it safe to say that, you know, a lot of what we've heard people talk about and seen ourselves this year is, yeah, certain parts of the economy are very weak. You have manufacturing's weak. The consumer still remains strong. What are you looking at in the housing market? Is it just blue skies ahead in the housing market? Is there, you know, and is there still yield there considering, you know, some people are still looking at that market with a jaundiced eye after the financial crisis?
Well, I think that in terms of the agency pass-through market, we're seeing a little bit of value there after the Fed has, you know, been rolling off and people have been scared out of that market a little bit. We're stabilizing it at attractive levels, and so we have some intermittent exposure there. But most of what you're seeing in the mortgage category is structured product that is actually away from residential.
Okay.
So you're going to be looking at a good amount of commercial mortgage-backed, where those asset prices have been firmer, but also where we tend to be in the top position in the capital structure, or in one of, at any rate, one of the very highly rated ones, unless... you know, in some exceptional cases, there could be a single asset type situation that's mid-rated, but there's much less of that. So predominantly high-quality commercial, and then a fair amount of collateralized loan obligations, CLOs. And this is a sector where you are collateralized by below investment grade loans. So an area that is not one of the best looking areas right here. That's an area that was technically very well supported because they're floating rate assets during the period of Fed rate hikes. Now the Fed is on hold, and so retail money is going out of those funds. Loan prices are under pressure. And there are concerns on asset quality. The underwriting was most aggressive there. But for diligent investors, I think, who can, you know, forage through the different managers, what exactly is in these deals, and then go right to the top of the capital structure, not in the middle, not at the bottom, that there are spreads available that are very competitive with intermediate and long-term corporate bonds that are much lower rated than a AAA CLO and have very competitive spreads, the CLOs. So I think it's a fair amount of that. Where we're looking to get some lower risk, lower beta spread at this point in the cycle.
Do you see any product offerings out there that do make cause for concern for those who maybe aren't doing their due diligence?
Cough, WeWork.
Cough. Yeah. Well, I think the loan area is one where you've had some, you know, changes. There's almost a terminology misplacement at this point, where a lot of those deals, they don't go through banks at all. So at one point, that market in its genesis, if you had an LBO or you had a lower rated company, they may have a range of different financing options. They may go to the high yield market. They may borrow collateralized in the bank loan market, and then that would be syndicated out. But that paper would be going through a major bank that would have a certain kind of underwriting process. Now, with the really large private equity pools out there and a lot of capital looking for deals, a lot of the loans are not going through a bank intermediary at all. There are a lot of very small deals much wider range of credit quality. And so, you know, as the economy is moderated a little bit, and you alluded to the stats on the economic side, you are seeing rising a number of companies that are missing their earnings forecast and seeing their bonds drop 10, 20, 40 points. And that's more so on the loan side for sure than in the high yield area.
I'm curious, you know, to get back to that 1% to 2% range on the 10-year yield that you see, is there an expiration date on that? If, say, we wake up next week and that phase one trade deal is signed, or is it, you think we'll stay in that range regardless of what happens with trade?
You can never say for sure, and we're investors, we're not forecasters. So if that situation changes, I have to change.
Yeah.
I have to get on the right side of it.
Yeah.
But my a priori is that the world has changed in a massive way after the financial crisis, and it has, in some respects, just begun. That the workforces in China and in Europe were growing until you got to the financial crisis, and now they have rolled over, they're actually shrinking. And so you're left in a world where debt is not rising at an astronomical rate, fueling growth, fueling profit growth, fueling spending, fueling investment, and where you have a growing population that needs a growing stock of goods, cars, housing, and so on, you're on the far side of that. And even in China, your car sales have rolled over, your retail square footage being put in place. This is a global phenomena where your growth rates are going to be much more modest. You're borrowing, again, for the real economy, much more modest. And so that 1.5% central tendency basically does not have a shelf life. I would think it's going to be there until we see some major change on the horizon that's going to take us to a much faster or slower plane of growth.
Regardless of the supply of treasuries coming into the market, I mean, we're looking at what, trillion-dollar deficits?
That's another good point I should differentiate, too. So when I look at the curve now, I will look at treasuries, but I really need to look at OIS. So OIS, or overnight index swaps, are based on the Fed funds rate. That is the rate that the Fed is controlling. The treasuries are really trading at big spreads relative to OIS because of the massive issuance. I don't think it's necessarily credit concerns, although at this pace, the U.S. over time will click down in ratings as debt to GDP rises and so on. When you look at the OIS curve, it's perfectly flat at about the effective Fed funds rate right now. But your treasury yields may, you know, vary around that depending on what happens with the deficit.
Chris, last question before we get to the craziest things that we will all share. How much do you think it's possible that this resumption of such a risk on fuel has to do with timing, that we're getting closer to 2020, we're less than a year away from the election, and that President Trump and the administration just can't screw up this U.S.-China deal?
Well, yeah, if you take part of his motive as being the beginning of that kind of a campaign, then yes, timing could be part of it. Of course, the election itself holds all kinds of volatility potential that we shouldn't undercount. It's not like that's just unanimously good tidings coming down over the horizon. But there's that. There's a general tendency for stocks to go up at the end of the year for all kinds of sort of window dressing-ish reasons. And, you know, just the end, this thing's been going on for so long, and there really isn't reason to believe that it's permanently settled at any level, and we shouldn't kid ourselves. But to the degree that it's getting late as far as when Trump can roll it back and sort of get the economy, or get the stock market, the economy, and these sort of sentiment proxies and under control, timing could be a factor for sure.
Speaking of timing, it's that time, Sarah. What is the craziest thing you saw in markets this week?
So I'm going to go back to, I believe, something we've spoken about before on the show, which is the Popeye's chicken sandwich, because its parent owner, which is Restaurant Brands International, it's a Canadian company. They also own Burger King. They also own Tim Hortons. There's been a lot of hype over this Popeye's chicken sandwich, and they're trying to kind of gain competition and gain traction from Chick-fil-A. Well, what happened was when they first came out with the sandwich, they did not have the manpower for it. So they had to hire more people at Popeyes, and Popeyes actually just had an unbelievable quarter in sales. But what's crazy, and it's pretty unbelievable and also a little bit sad, I must say, there was so much demand at this one Popeyes location that a fight broke out over a chicken sandwich in line, and it actually ended in a fatality.
Oh my gosh.
Which
really?
Is, yeah. Unbelievable that you get to that point. But it just shows you what they're trying to do to gain competition, gain traction, is leading to other issues for the company in the long haul.
Robert, did they tell you about our gimmick here, the craziest thing in markets that we've seen?
You know, I did hear about it, but I don't have any content for you.
Okay. That's all right. That's
yeah,
right.
I mean, for me, every day, wake up, look at the markets, I'm totally shocked and have to figure it out from there.
Would you say a 17 basis point swing in 10 years on Thursday was pretty crazy?
I think the swings that we're seeing and market swings in sentiment on trade and on positioning and fixed income, they have been a little shocking.
Chris, as I think you possibly are our first five-timer guest here.
Wow, wow.
Yeah.
I'm like the Paul Simon.
You are, yeah. We're going to get you the smoking jacket
right.
And everything. Have you witnessed anything crazy in markets?
I would say there's this thing that happened this week. Sarah wrote it up. This guy, Cliff Asness, he adores our coverage of the stock. But he can't say enough good things about it.
We got to get him on sometime.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Whew. But anyway, he put out a note where he said that he runs AQR Capital Management, big hedge fund that runs equity factors, which means that they own things like high dividend stocks and low valuation stocks, value stocks. And his whole thing is to basically program his computers and step back. It's kind of like really like advanced calculus, passive investing. And they're incredibly rich and successful and huge. And really is one of the smartest guys really on earth. And, but so he came out with a note saying, so his big thing is you don't jump in and out of markets. You sit and let the computers do their work, let the factors run. He went out with a note saying, now might be a time, value stock, cheap stocks have gotten so cheap that it might be a time to sort of try to market time, to take sort of opportunistic stabs at them, which for him, I mean, it's hard to describe. It's so outside of his usual worldview and philosophy for him to come in and say, act like, he's not saying act like a day trader, but you could translate that. He'd probably expect us to translate that into one of our stories. But given some of the wars he's had on Twitter and in public about trying to time factors with another guy, a guy we had on the show, Rob Arnott. Mm-hmm. They've really gotten into up in each other's face about it. But now Cliff is saying, you know, factors value is so cheap that maybe in this limited instance, it's okay to day trade.
He says modest overweight.
Yeah.
Maybe right. The same as day trading.
I don't want to oversell it.
Cliff, if you're listening, you can call the What Goes Up hotline and correct whatever Chris got wrong in that description, which was nothing, obviously. All right. Time for mine. I hate to pat myself on the back, but I think I got the best one here.
You do. You've probably I can tell.
So we've all heard about this price war in the retail brokerage industry, Charles Schwab cutting commissions to zero. Well, the firm that really got it started, Robinhood, a few years ago, the first to offer commission-free trading. Now they're one-upping everyone by offering "quote unquote infinite leverage."
Okay, offering know, is probably pushing.
Not exactly offering.
There is a glitch in the system.
A glitch in the system. And of all places, it came out on Reddit. Someone basically outed them for this.
Of course, it would come out on Reddit of all places.
Yeah, I guess I have to read Reddit now. But basically, if I get it right, what happens is you take out a margin loan, you buy a bunch of stock, then you sell a bunch of covered calls based on that position. With the money you collect from the selling the covered calls, you buy more stock with more leverage. You sell calls on them, and on it goes. Robert, if you had infinite leverage, what would you buy?
Oh my God! Listen, you know, after your description of assets at AQR, I'm just a bond guy. You know, if we didn't have a top performing fund, I would have a complete complex at this point. But we don't go to infinite leverage.
Wisely so.
Only Robin Hood in a glitch. With that said, though, I think, Mike, you did win it this time. It was pretty unbelievable seeing that story this week. But Robert Tipp, Chris Nagy, thank you so much for joining the show this week.
Thanks.
Thank you.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek, Mike is at Reaganonymous, and Chris Nagy is at ChrisNagy1. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcast at Podcast. And don't forget, you can also give us a call at our very own Bloomberg Podcast hotline. That number is 646-324-3490. And if you leave a message, we may even play it on the show. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcast is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.